Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. We hear from a federal disaster team out in the Western Pacific where a super typhoon hit 3 weeks ago, packing devastating winds and rain. The death toll has reached 17 across various islands in Micronesia, and the latest reports it could be months before power is fully restored. We check back in on the early education initiatives that were making their way through the legislature. What happens to the preschool push now that Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke has taken a leave of absence? We also get a chance to talk to Keith Regan, the acting lieutenant governor, who's still wearing his state comptroller hat, what it's like while he has one foot in each office. And in the waning days of the state legislative session, we take a look at an online tool that was used to track the state budget. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Super typhoon Sinlaku hit the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas about 3 weeks ago. The winds in excess of 145 miles an hour downed more than 620 power poles on the island of Saipan, and nearly all of that island remains without electricity. Its hospital is operating on generator power from the U.S. Navy. And slowly water is being restored. Power, though, may not be fully restored for another 90 days. And electrical crews from Guam are assisting in the recovery. Carl Banks is the incident commander for a team dispatched by the Environmental Protection Agency out of the Region 9 office in California. He says its focus has been on restoring clean water as hazardous material cleanup efforts have been tasked to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Banks talked to us from Saipan, where team members were pre-positioned in the region before the storm hit. The storm claimed 17 lives, including half a dozen mariners whose cargo ship was found overturned in the open ocean. Here's Banks.
First of all, our condolences go out to the victims, as well as our concern for the survivors. US EPA has responded to all the major storms over the last decade, starting with Typhoon Sutilur, Typhoon Yutu, Typhoon Mawar, and now Sinlaku. We generally have a team that is flexible based on the needs. So I think our maximum deployment was 22 people in total, but only about half of those were on island because of the lack of resources, lodging, rental cars, et cetera. So we had to have, at FEMA's request, a pretty light footprint. But we have been able to achieve all of our mission requirements in under 30 days.
So tell us, your focus has been mainly water.
Indeed. The US EPA sometimes does hazardous materials removal, which this time on Saipan is being conducted by US Army Corps of Engineers. But we also have always had a water mission in support of the water and wastewater sector here on island. So our focus has been to work with Commonwealth Utilities Corporation, CUC, the main utility here on island, though our role with them has been mostly technical assistance and not as much hands-on work. We've done some assessments of their facilities. The main thrust of our work has been to test water from the sources of water that people use on the island, as the water that comes from CUC is potable and meets all standards, but is not typically drinkable by the population here. So most of their water comes from water vendors who apply additional secondary treatment to the CUC water or their own sources to provide drinkable water that people buy in 5-gallon jugs. So we needed to make sure in support of the Bureau of Environmental and Coastal Quality, BECQ, that the water was indeed safe to drink. So we've taken samples all around the island from water vendors, from public water systems, which are sometimes restaurants, sometimes hotels, as well as the CUC public water systems. And by taking the samples and providing some technical assistance, we've been able to make sure that water is indeed meeting standards and that this information allowed DEQ to approve their use for drinking.
Yes, and, you know, growing up with super typhoons, I know that you can be without power for a very long time. And a lot of that power is tied to, like, water pumps. And if you don't have water, I mean, that's the problem for families, not just for drinking, but just basic things, flushing the toilets, washing. And we saw with the back-to-back storms here on Oahu, the problems they had on the North Shore with the water notices and how folks were having to boil their water. But it's those very basic things you take for granted.
Indeed. Without power, it is basically impossible to have sufficient water here in the islands. And so there's been parallel efforts. CUC has been working to bring up the power, which is also in their purview. And then, of course, their pumps and tanks to provide that water for sanitation and as source water for drinking water treatment by the vendors. We have also had a hand in trying to prioritize some generator support for these larger water vendors so that there would be sufficient drinking water available on the island. So we've kind of gotten involved in power, although that is not our direct responsibility in this case. Rather, it's conducted by FEMA with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
When you mentioned that in the past you often deal with hazardous materials, and we saw the work that you folks did with the Lahaina wildfires and the problems that we had with so many electric cars and solar units that just created a whole different level of hazardous waste. And that was quite the ordeal, shipping all of those off. But you mentioned that the Army Corps is mainly handling that aspect of it with the boots on the ground.
Correct. So this time, because of the limited ability of responders to take up space here on the island, like I mentioned, cars and lodging, FEMA went with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do both the hazardous materials removal and the general debris removal. And so they're undertaking that mission assignment. I can't really speak to their progress. What is different in comparison to the wildfires in Lahaina was that we don't have, my observation is not nearly the lithium-ion battery issue that we had there, because the super typhoon generally wasn't destructive when it came to electric cars, other than cosmetic damages. So we don't see the same issue with the battery disposal that we saw in Lahaina.
I understand that a lot of the crews are coming from Guam to help re-energize the island, right? To assess the damage to the down poles and figure out how to get things back up and running again. I recall, gosh, back in the day when Guam got hit, that crews from Hawaiian Electric here sent teams over to help assist. So everybody's just trying to help people in need and do this as quickly as they can. But you folks are over there, and I don't know what the conditions are, let's say, on Tinian or the other islands, because it can be tricky when you've got to get supplies from one place to another.
Indeed. We have also had crews on Tinian and Rota to check in on the water situation on those two islands as well. Generally speaking, though the infrastructure is smaller, it also is in better standing at this point. Boil water notice on Rota was lifted, and they're sort of on the cusp of lifting the boil water notice for Tinian. So what we can say is that they're in somewhat better shape, although emergency power on Tinian is still a big issue, and being able to produce enough water and ice for drinking purposes and food preservation and medicine preservation purposes is limited on Tinian. So we're still monitoring that situation there. You mentioned the mutual aid. I know a whole group of electrical linemen came from Guam and started work here, and we saw them working at night. So there is a lot of teamwork occurring and all hands on deck to get things back up and running here.
We also heard about a couple of fatalities in Chuuk, and I'm not sure what agencies are helping those governments with their needs. Are you hearing anything about those islands?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have any information on that, so I can't really respond to that.
Okay. But anything else that you want to stress just about the conditions there? Because I understand that, yeah, early on, you only had power for maybe a couple hours a day.
Yes, indeed. If there's not a generator running, in general, you don't have power. So we have limited generator support for our incident command post, which is located with BECQ at this time, and in our lodging, we have limited power. So it does make things more challenging, but of course, we're very cognizant that our home wasn't destroyed, our families weren't displaced. And so we keep that in mind, and we don't complain about the conditions we're working under. Again, as I mentioned, we were here for Sogdlur, Utu, Mawar. We'll be back for the next one. A lot of us have ties here and work with them on a normal basis for drinking water and wastewater, et cetera. So Saipan and Sinamai and all the islands are very much close to our hearts, and we're happy to serve.
And so how long do you think you folks will be out there? Any sense yet?
Yeah, so the good news is that the bulk of the emergency response work for drinking water and wastewater has been completed, and all response is intended to begin local and end local. And so we are looking at our demobilization because the magnitude, the need for additional sampling and assessment is back to baseline. All the drinking water and wastewater issues, we're not out of the woods here, but as is our mandate, when the local responders and the local agencies can take over, we're mandated to step back. So we're going to be leaving here in about a week. But we're trying to do our best due diligence to make sure we don't leave anyone with unmet needs. So we are this week picking up the remaining tasks and getting them to be completed before we depart.
And that was EPA Incident Commander Carl Banks from the Region 9 office in California. He and a team are in Saipan helping in the aftermath of Super Typhoon Sinlaku.
Support for HPR comes from Small Business Chamber of Commerce Hawaii, partnering with HMAA to provide health insurance for businesses across multiple industries. Learn more at smallbizhawaii.com.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. The extraordinary reach of New York Times journalism brings you the sound and the story. Times reporters unpack more of what you want to know about our nation and our world as it happens. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Preschool advocates are wringing their hands over the state's ambitious goals to expand early education across the state and the lack of money set aside to advance those goals. Joining us this morning is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Megan Tagami. Good morning, Megan.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, so you were tracking a lot of the preschool bills, the bills for early education.
Right. There was a handful of bills that got introduced this year relating to funding preschools and building up the teacher workforce, but a lot of them required some kind of state funding, and those bills just didn't make it through the legislative session this year.
Yeah, and you know, we know that Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke was spearheading the Keiki Ready programs, you know, the effort to build more preschool classrooms and to get them staffed, but then she has stepped away.
Right. You know, Sylvia Luke launched the Ready Keiki initiative in 2023. It set out this roadmap for really aggressively expanding and building preschools over the next several years. And now advocates are saying, you know, they really are looking for someone at the state level to take this initiative on and to kind of keep the momentum going.
Well, of the bills that were that you were tracking, you know, what happened?
Right. So one of the big bills was to provide state support for these family learning programs that have typically relied pretty heavily on federal grants. The federal funding, you know, for this next grant application cycle hasn't really come through. There's a lot of uncertainty. So these nonprofit leaders were asking the state for more money to fund these programs that target, you know, rural and low-income communities. The funding didn't come through from the state, so at least 17 of these programs are supposed to close in the fall. There's other bills relating to funding charter preschools at a higher level than they currently receive from the state funding. These preschools have to make up, you know, thousands of dollars on their own to kind of cover the costs of running their schools, and funding from the state also didn't come through. And then the last bill that, you know, I was tracking was a teacher apprenticeship bill. It would kind of build up the early learning teacher workforce, which has huge shortages right now. But unfortunately, that bill also did not pass through conference committee on Friday, and that also needed some money as well.
So do we have a sense as to how many families we're talking about that will be, you know, left without these programs, you know, because the fall is just around the corner?
Right. So the 17 programs that could close because of the lack of federal funding, those are supposed to affect around 1,000 children and then 1,000 of their caregivers, because the model is that, you know, kids learn alongside their aunties or uncles or parents. Some county funding might come through, so the cuts might not be as severe, but we're still talking about a large number of kids.
And when we're talking charter schools, I mean, versus a regular school, I mean, does that mean what, they have more flexibility and they can pivot faster?
Right. So the charter schools, they receive state funding, they're tuition free, but really it's kind of a new model that's being rolled out to try and see if it's another way to build more preschool classrooms faster, kind of have a flexible model to respond to families' needs and just get schools, you know, started in high need areas in a kind of fast and efficient way. But these schools say that they need a lot more funding than the state is currently setting aside for their classrooms.
And where are those charter schools located?
The two charter schools right now are located in Kapolei and then one in Waikiki. They both opened in the past year or so they're fairly new.
Okay, so those families are going to find themselves a big puka for care.
Right, those charter preschools, they're still keeping their classrooms open. They're not planning on cutting back their services, but they said, you know, for other schools that are looking to become charter preschools as well, there's a big funding challenge, and, you know, families are really looking for that kind of care.
Yeah, so it is a dilemma, you know, when you have folks who are, you know, working parents who rely on these programs to provide the care. They're going to be probably scrambling if the county doesn't step in some way.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely a need for more care and for more teachers as well on the workforce side.
All right. Okay. Well, I guess they can always try again next year. But thanks so much, Megan.
Thank you.
That was Megan Tagami. You can look for her story at civilbeat.org. And we do plan to hear next from Acting Lieutenant Governor Keith Regan, so don't go away. Career public servant is filling in for Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke as she has taken an indefinite unpaid leave of absence. Keith Regan is serving as comptroller and the acting lieutenant governor for the state. He previously worked for the County of Maui and Hawaii Tourism Authority. Regan stopped by our studios yesterday and spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about balancing the role with his other full-time job, running the Department of Accounting and General Services.
I've been a public servant now for more than 19 years. And one of the things that I've learned over that span of time is that when you're asked to serve in roles that you're not maybe expecting, that you need to step up and be available to those who are counting on you. And that has been my entire approach throughout my entire career in government, whether it be at the local level or at the state level. When I took the job 3 years ago, I understood that with that with this position as comptroller that I had a certain responsibility, not only to the department and not only statutory responsibilities, but even from a potential succession responsibility that it exists within sort of that framework. And I will say it wasn't front of mind, but it's something that was in sort of in the back of my mind that, hey, this could happen. You have to be ready for it if it does and be prepared. And so I continued to do my work. And when this situation presented itself, it was something that I was prepared to at least explore and understand and determine whether or not it was right.
I read the article in the paper about you, that you're working 11-hour days, working weekends out of the LG's conference room. It seems like you're burning the candle at both ends right now.
It's been workable at this point. I don't know how long I can sustain it, but I will say that, as I mentioned in that article, I have tremendous respect for Lieutenant Governor Luke, and I have the utmost and tremendous respect for my boss, Governor Green, as well as an understanding that the team that's there, both in the Lieutenant Governor's office and within my DAGS team, both need that continued nurturing, support, and guidance. And for me, I just feel like it's an opportunity to provide that support to them in a respectful, meaningful way to bring some stability to the team while we're in these relatively unstable times, I guess is the best way that I can put it. Continue some of the good work that Lieutenant Governor Luke, you know, was pushing forward on with her initiatives, and with the understanding that she could come back at any time. She could come back in a week, 2 weeks, or a month from now, or who knows when. And for as long as that may be, I will do my best to serve in my roles to make sure that the job gets done and that the work of government continues.
But I can imagine, knowing that you're filling a 1 week leave of absence as opposed to it could be until December, that long an absence might change your priorities in terms of what you would do in the role.
Clearly, that's something that we would have to explore as the time ticks by. I will say that I have a great team at DAGS. My deputy comptroller, who is currently serving as acting comptroller, is well versed and seasoned and experienced. And so she has really stepped up during this time as well to help. But, you know, it's something that we're going to have to revisit as we go forward and try to figure out how I can rebalance my life. Because in addition to work, I also have a family that is very important to me. And I want to make sure that, you know, I'm able to split my time, not only at work, but also to give that support to my family.
You mentioned some of the initiatives that Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke had prioritized, including, you know, access to preschool and high-speed internet in rural communities. Are those initiatives that the office under you as acting LG will continue to work on?
Yeah. So I just met with the policy team last week, and they briefed me on all of her initiatives, gave me a good overview. And we're still going to have more conversations about those initiatives because it was very high level. There were so many things going on last week. It was hard to get into anything really in depth. And so they're all great initiatives. One of the things that I felt we needed to do was start to look at which department is probably most connected with those initiatives and which department can step up to continue to sort of carry that ball towards the finish line so that Lieutenant Governor Luke's initiatives continue to have momentum and move forward, and that they can work closely with the team, right, that's there within the Lieutenant Governor's office. And that's really kind of where we are with all of those policies and initiatives that we have, is continuing to do the good work that's there so that nothing drops off and sort of gets lost in this process.
One final question for you. We've heard from listeners and for good government advocates that this time, this scandal, controversy, call it whatever you will, the fact that a target letter was sent to Sylvia Luke the lieutenant governor, people, their trust in our elected officials has been rattled. So as acting lieutenant governor, what would you say to people who are hoping for their trust to be restored in our elected officials?
I would say trust in the process. The process is there for a reason. You have to be patient with that process because, like anything else, there are activities that are going on that, you know, are going to eventually lead to an outcome. And I will just say that there are many good public servants that dedicate themselves day in and day out to ensure that government functions properly and that we carry out our responsibilities on a daily basis. There are really great people working for state government and working for county government who care about what they're doing. They're not just there for a paycheck. They're not there for, you know, any other reason but because they really believe in what they're doing. And I would say that a majority of those people are working every single day hard to make sure that they can earn the public's trust and deliver the services that the public rely upon. That's the story that I've come across in my 19 years of working in government service at various levels, is that public servants really believe in what they're doing. And I would just ask the public to be patient and allow the process to work itself out, and that an outcome will come forward out of that process.
That was Acting Lieutenant Governor Keith Regan and HPR's Maddie Bender. Tomorrow, we plan to share more from this interview with Regan and Jimmy Carata from the Department of Accounting and General Services about the state's new cemetery division.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, inspiring people of all ages with classes in painting, ceramics, printmaking, and more. Registration for summer session opens May 19th, honolulumuseum.org.
You are invited to play trivia with HPR Generation Listen on the first Tuesday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and meet with fellow HPR fans. Generation Listen is an HPR initiative that connects young and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for HPR comes from NAREIT Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NAREITHawaii.com.
You know, state lawmakers put the budget to bed last week. In this session, the Hawaii Appleseed launched an updated tool to help it track the changes. Devin Thomas from the Progressive Think Tank spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen recently. The free budget tracker tool can help compare the state's budget's many forms and revisions so that users can easily see how the money gets allocated and reallocated during this legislative session. Here's Thomas.
What some people say is that the budget is a statement of values, right? It displays very clearly what our priorities are as residents of Hawaii. And for that reason, what you can see reflected in the budget is our investments in priorities that matter the most to us: affordable housing, food security, the social safety net for low to middle income residents, people who are struggling to make ends meet. That's why I think the budget is important. And I think a lot of people would agree too. The budget is also something that is in flux. It's constantly changing from year to year. The process of crafting the budget is very complicated. And that was one of the main reasons why we decided to get into this project of tracking it. It's a pretty opaque process, and it's one that could be made a lot more accessible to the public, which we're trying to do.
And I think to me, that is the most ingenious part about the tracker that you've built, is that I think for a lot of people, this deluge of information can be something that is really intimidating. And you guys have made your tracker in a way that for a lot of people, myself included, is easy to use. Really emphasize why that was such an important design decision.
For context, for folks who have not looked at the actual budget bill, it is not the easiest document to parse. It's a wall of text. There are columns technically, but there aren't cells. There aren't clearly defined rows that you can easily pick out. It's something that you have to really stare at for a long time and painstakingly go through in order to extract the information that you need. And you have no easy way of comparing one draft to the other, right? So if you want to see how appropriations for 1 year change throughout the session, you just have to go through each draft and, you know, write it down, put it in a spreadsheet, however you want to do it. It's not straightforward at all. For that reason, we can't expect the general public, or even a lot of people in policy for that matter, to be able to understand how the budget works, what exactly is happening in terms of appropriations, what's being added, removed, etc. What we've tried to do, what I've really tried to focus on with this, is to put everything into an online format, one where you can search for appropriations, you can order the columns in terms of largest to smallest appropriations, in terms of what were the biggest reductions, additions from one draft to the next. So I've just tried to make it as sortable, as intuitive as I can, and I'm still not where I want to be. It's still not, I would say, immediately accessible to someone who has no idea about the budget, but it at least is a step along the way, and we're trying to iterate.
And again, I think it's really important to note here how, you know, again, you said you can compare these drafts and you can compare, mm-hmm. you can compare a lot of things. What I really like about it is you can compare a lot of, well, this is what it looked like in the budget looked like in the House. Yeah. This is what it looks like in the Senate. This is what
yes.
the governor had requested.
Yeah.
For everyday people, why does it matter so much, those differences? Like, what information can people glean from those mm-hmm. differences, and why you guys are offering those comparisons?
Sure. I think the most important comparisons, the most important takeaways that people can glean from looking at this, well, number one, right, they can see how complicated the process is.
Yeah, you from definitely one draft can. To the next.
Right. And it may seem nonsensical in some ways. I've never been in the room for these decisions that are being made on the budget, but you can see that huge changes are made. And it's normal, right? It's normal for the governor in his initial request to make a request that gets whittled down from one draft to the next over time. One of the reasons why we also decided to do this tracker now is because our state is confronting a financial crisis in a way, right? We're facing the prospect of losing hundreds of millions in federal funds. And this is forcing our legislature to make some tough decisions. Do we want to raise taxes? Do we want to cut programs in order to fill those gaps? And those are probably some of the most important takeaways that you can see with the tracker this year anyway, as it's following the budget bill, is you can get a sense of what's going on inside the heads of our legislators. So you can see some of the reasoning, although it's not very detailed, the reasoning behind these decisions. And you can assess for yourself what does or doesn't make sense, what you may or may not agree with. So that's one of the things that I'm really trying to accomplish with this, is I'm trying to give people all these tools to analyze the budget for themselves.
Civic engagement, right? Like, it's important that people are able to do this research on their own, come to their own conclusions, and kind of have that information out there. And I have to imagine that even putting a tracker like this together with the astounding amount of information and all, literally every sect of life that the government touches and is putting money in and out of, That must have been quite an undertaking itself. I mean, what was it like building this tracker?
It was a very painful process to build this. And that process started last year when we released our budget primer, the updated one. At that time, I made the decision, the fateful decision, to try to build a scraper, meaning a piece of code that would be able to go into the budget document and recognize patterns, using those patterns, extract the relevant numbers, right, for programs, for departments, and then put that into a digestible format, a spreadsheet.
Sure.
So that took a long time. It was worth the investment because I was able to transfer some of that that progress to this tool. And really, it was a matter of, going in there, understanding how the budget is laid out currently, understanding the best way to pick out those numbers that otherwise you would have to manually write down. But then also, as an aside, right, the format is not the same across the board for everything, because when you get to the governor's request, to what the governor puts forward before every session in terms of what his admin wants, that's in a completely different format. So that took a lot of time too.
It's like they're trying to make it hard for you or something.
Yeah, right. I mean, some could say that in a ways it's,
purposefully obtuse.
Yeah, they certainly aren't trying very hard to make it accessible. So it was a very long process. And then even once you have all that, right, it's the question of how do I make this easy to understand for someone who has little to no idea about the budget, about policy in general. So that's where I had to think about, okay, tooltips for every acronym, for every term in the budget. And there are so many, limitless, really. And so much so that people who work in this line of work can't remember what everything means. They have to refer to, a list of definitions, etc. So I just tried to cover all of those bases the best that I could, So if you go in there now, what you can see is that for a lot of cells, for a lot of text boxes, you can hover over those and it'll show you a definition of what it means. It'll give you a breakdown in the case of some numbers. And that's really, I think, a critical component, right? Because it's one thing to show people what the data is, but you also have to give them a sense of what it means, because it's not as straightforward as we're adding money, we're taking away money every time. Sometimes they're moving money around. Sometimes they're switching from one fund to another. It's not always the most direct process.
If the state budget really reflects our values as a community, as a state, how does the state budget tracker reflect the values of Hawaii Appleseed?
It embodies our really earnest desire to involve everyone in policy, to catalyze that interest that I believe is in each and every one of not only the listeners of this program, but within the general public too. Because what happens in the budget affects all of us, right? And as a state, we have to be thinking about what benefits us collectively. How do we make the best investments, not just for us, but for our kids? And we've been striving for so long to make policy more understandable, more accessible for people who don't care at all about it. And it's been difficult, right? The way I see it now, right, especially when it comes to the younger population, is you see a lot of apathy, right? And it's because, for many reasons, but one of those being they don't have the tools readily available to be able to understand how this affects them. So they don't care. And we're trying to fix that.
That was Devin Thomas of Hawaii Appleseed and HPR's Kevin Allen. They were talking about using a free online tool to help track the progress of the state budget. You can try out the budget tracker for yourself. Visit our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, to find links to the tool.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For nearly 90 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, Epic Systems maintains health records for more than 80% of Americans.
I think most of us who work here would hesitate to go to a place that doesn't have our software because they realize it does help save lives.
We visit Judy Faulkner, the unusual founder and CEO of an unusual company. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting Hawaiian artist Josh Tatofi, performing this Friday and Saturday in two sets nightly, with songs such as Perfect to Me and I'm Gonna Love You. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
You know, on our show yesterday, we heard about the first statewide high school surfing championships held on Maui. It was an event years in the making, and advocates are already thinking about ways to make the sport more accessible to young people. Today, we learn about a group doing just that. Surfrider Spirit Sessions is a nonprofit that pairs at-risk youth with capable adult surf mentors. Because for many, surfing isn't just about riding the waves. It's about finding peace in a world where peace can be hard to find. Cynthia DeRozier founded the nonprofit two decades ago. She recently spoke with HBR's Kevin Allen about the mission of Surfrider Spirit Sessions. She starts by describing what it's like to ride a wave.
You know, there's a saying, only a surfer knows the feeling, and it's true. Just having this sort of force of nature pick you up and carry you, it's exhilarating, right? But the Hawaiians believe that it's actually a way of replenishing your mana, right? Building your spirit, connecting to Aina and to Kai somehow makes you stronger and more whole. And I challenge anyone, whether you surf or not, notice how you feel before you jump in the ocean, even if you're just wading in the water, and then how you feel when you come out. And you will feel a difference.
And that's something that I feel is very important to what you're doing with Surfrider Spirit Sessions.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because I was talking to our team, and this year is our 20th year, and we're calling it the Spirit of Spirit Sessions because nobody thought we'd be around this long. So the Spirit of Spirit Sessions is getting kids to connect to that inner power, to root themselves in their na'au, in their center, feel that they are a spiritual being, that they're powerful, that they can overcome challenges, that they can grow into new ways. And we do it through surfing. So we work with kids, you know, we call them at risk or vulnerable. The truth is a lot of kids, all kids are at risk or vulnerable. If any of us think back to being a teenager or a preteen, it's hard, right? It's rough. You want autonomy, you want to be in control, but really you're not. But we also get the kids who are having greater challenges than most, right? So these are kids that have suffered the whole gamut. We initially started working with kids in the court system. And what you find out is many of these kids, they're doing quote unquote bad things, but kids are not doing bad things to do bad things. If you dig a little deeper, there's a reason for it. So, you know, oh yeah, this kid's stealing. Okay, well, what's he stealing? He's stealing food. Well, why? Is there not enough food at home? You know, we have had kids whose parents were addicted to drugs, and so these kids then became the parent. So we started out working with kids in the court system, but since that time, the courts are taking less kids, and so many of our kids are getting referred to us through teachers, counselors. They're not bad kids, but we have a lot of kids that are victims of bullying. Some of them are the bulliers. Some of them are English as a second language, so they're kind of marginalized in school. They're being teased. They're being made fun of. And then we have other kids, maybe LGBTQ, and they're feeling that pressure. But whatever the cause or the root of their challenge or their trauma, the kids are all suffering and struggling with something. And so what we do is we match each kid with a mentor who knows how to surf. And by the way, you know, for kids, surfing's cool, right? So, hey, I'm scared, I'm nervous, but surfing's cool. I get to hang out with cool people. And then you put an adult, and I don't know about you, but when I was a teenager, I didn't want to talk to adults. But if there's an adult who's going to teach me how to surf and make me cool, I'm in.
Right. You're trying to build that bond between student and mentor. Yep. And I'm sure it goes even beyond just surfing, that trust.
Absolutely. So it starts off in the water, right? You gain trust because the kid is already like, I'm scared, I'm nervous, I don't know what to do. I got this giant board. I have no idea what's happening. But you've got this mentor next to you going, hey, okay, turn left. Okay, don't worry, calm down. Oh, here's a wave, paddle up over, you know, just with you the whole time. And you catch a wave and you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like every single kid, I love sitting on the inside and watching them catch their first wave.
It must be all smiles.
Oh my God. Yeah. The eyeballs are like three times the size. They're all teeth and they are just smiling and grinning and just so happy. And they're like, I want to do it again. And the funny thing is they go from being like, I don't know if I can surf or I can't do this, to all of a sudden being like, I want to try again. Right? Whether they succeeded or failed on their first attempt, they all turn around, paddle back out, and go for it.
And that's kind of a great lesson in life, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is wonderful, and it's getting kids out in the water, but it's also just teaching them such valuable life skills and preparing them for whatever challenging situations that might be at home or at school.
Right. So going back to the original question about how did this start, when I first started surfing, I became a maniac. And at some point, one night I woke up and I couldn't sleep because I kept seeing pictures and words. So now we call them memes. Back in the day, it was like successories or whatever, right? Just a picture and then some words, inspiration. And I couldn't sleep, so I just started sketching it out. And halfway through, I was like, oh my God, this is a book. And I thought, what the heck, just for fun, I'm gonna like design this book and see what happens. And next thing I know, we published it. It became a bestseller here locally. And I had already decided that I would take the money and donate it to Surfrider Foundation. So we began actually at Surfrider Foundation. I was asked separately, because I also have a background in child art therapy, when it was a new thing, I was asked to work with a group of girls. And hey, they've been having some trouble. Can you come down and work? No problem. This friend of a friend asked me. So I went, not realizing that they were girls in a program called Girls Court. So I run this program. At the end, the counselor comes to me and she goes, oh my God, Sin, you're the one that did that book. And I said, yeah. She goes, oh my God, can you teach the kids how to do a book? And I said, no. Well, yes, but why? And she said, well, I want them to learn the lessons in the book. So the book is really just about how surfing is a metaphor for life. For example, we don't get to choose how big the waves are or when they arrive, but we do get to choose if we're going to paddle for it, if we're going to let it go, if we're going to get out of the water, jump in the water. You know, we get to make choices. We get to respond to the choices that are offered to us. So anyway, she says, can you teach them how to do a book? I say, well, why? And she says, to learn the lesson. And I said, well, you know, in order for them to learn the lesson, we'd have to actually take them out on the water. Next thing I know, she's bringing the judge over and she's like, she's going to take them surfing. And I was like, no. I never said that. No, you're going to do it. And just, they got super excited. So I talked to my friend Marvin Heskett, who is the vice chair of the Surfrider board. And we were out surfing one day. So I told him about this. And he's like, you know what, Sin? He goes, why don't we just do it? We'll use the money because it's just sitting there at the Surfrider funds. Let's go for it. And so we developed this pilot model. And the first day we went out and we took the kids out, the judge, who doesn't body surf or surf, was standing in the water, jumping up and down, going, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then she had told me that all of these girls had been through such significant trauma in their life. Some of them had been trafficked. Some of them had been homeless and didn't have food. And this is the first time she had seen them in 6 months smiling. And the funny thing is, when we came in, all of a sudden, they don't know anything about these mentors except for the fact that the mentors surf. But then the girls would be like, oh my God, talking to these adults, asking them what they did for work. One of the instructors was a doctor and also a yoga instructor. So then the girls wanted to learn yoga and they wanted to know what it took to become a doctor. And another one was a police officer. So professions that they didn't even realize exist or hadn't considered, suddenly it became something, well, I didn't think I could surf, and now I can. And I didn't think I could ever be a doctor, but I'm hanging out with a doctor. Maybe I can.
Right. All of these avenues were starting to present themselves.
Yeah.
All these doors were opening.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important, too, that we talk about just how important these mentors are. Because again, it's who the kids are talking to in the water.
It's life-changing on both sides, right? So we talk about any mentor who joins our group or any youth who comes to our programs becomes part of our surf ohana, right? And the ocean is the thing that unites us, that we have in common. But the bonds that form are incredible. I personally am not the person that's making the change, right? Our staff, we're there to facilitate space, to create a space where those connections are made. So in terms of the mentors, they come from all walks of life. They have to pass an FBI background check. They go through a training. And then during the core program, the 8-week session, we're there to support them and help facilitate those relationships. All they have to do is show up. And the great thing about our program is the kids have their dedicated mentor, but they also get exposure to 10 to 15 other mentors. And they get exposure to other kids. And so what happens is this, like, I don't want to say group therapy, but there's this group bonding that happens, right? And these shared experiences, both positive and negative. And when I say negative, I just mean, oh, you wiped out. Okay, we always say, so then what? They're like, well, I'm going to get back out and get back on my board and try again. We're like, great. So you failed a test. So what? At school, right? You failed your test. So now what are you going to do? Oh, get back and try again. So we take things that happen in the water and we correlate it to life. And the mentors are the ones who do that. It's super neat. Come join us. Come join us. We're growing our ohana.
And you've been growing it for 20 years now.
20 years.
And you'd said previously that even you're surprised that you've made it 20 years. I mean, just being a nonprofit for that long, how has that journey been, you know?
It's tough. I mean, you know, my other job is I do strategic planning and facilitation. But this job as a executive director is by far the hardest job I've ever done. We're always under-resourced. People wear multiple hats. We've got to do a lot of things. I think the fact that we've been around for 20 years really speaks to the impact that we have. In the past 20 years, 100% of our kids who have gone through our program are having positive shifts in three or more areas. So the number one area we see positive shift is self-esteem and confidence. Then pro-social networks, so having a positive support system. And then there's learning and desire to practice and perpetuate Hawaiian culture, caring about the environment, and then healthy physical activities. But 100% of our kids, we know, are positively impacted. So I think that's part of it. And the other part of it is it's our surf ohana, right? You go to our program for 8 weeks, whether you're a youth or a mentor, but those connections you make continue beyond the 8 weeks. And I will say this, when we started, it was supposed to be a one-day thing. And then it just, okay, let's go a little further. Let's go a little further. And in all honesty, there are times where, like, I don't know if we're going to make it. And then something shows up and lifts us back up.
It was the spirit.
It's the spirit of spirit sessions. Yeah.
It keeps coming back.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Chee-hoo.
That was Surf Rider Spirit Sessions founder Cynthia DeRozier talking to HPR's Kevin Allen. If you'd like to get involved as a volunteer mentor, you can find links on our website for more details after the show. That wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to get behind the Manu Minute, how Oli or chants are helping to provide cultural context for our native birds. What's on your mind? Rising costs? Share your comments or questions by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.